Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable for this Thursday. It is 14 minutes past 9 o'clock. I'm Joe Donahue, and we have a great show. We have a wonderful panel. We have a lot of interesting items to discuss, and we'll get to all of that in just a moment. And we welcome you, and we're so glad that you have taken some time out to be with us. And let me just put it this way. You're very good company. So we love you very much, and we thank you for everything that you do. I'll get more into that in just a second. If you'd like to be a part of the program, all you have to do is write to us, panel at wamc.org, panel at wamc.org. Let me introduce the panel to you this morning. It is an impressive bunch. Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm very pleased to be back.
It is wonderful to have you back. Please introduce your special guest.
Oh, yes. I was thrilled I could bring a special guest today. We have Svetlana here, a student at Bard, and I'll let her introduce herself a little bit. Good morning, Svetlana.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's a pleasure for me to be here, and I'm excited to discuss all the different topics today.
Now, what is you're majoring in human rights,
right,
at Bard College?
Yes.
And what brought you down that path, do you think?
So I got a chance to receive a unique scholarship for Ukrainian students following the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, because I did study at the university in Ukraine, but after Russia started shelling the critical infrastructure, I just didn't have a chance to safely and normally continue my education. And then I found out about this great scholarship at Bard, and I'm just grateful to be here and for my parents not to worry.
So, well, yes, any opportunity you have for your parents not to worry, take it. But by the way, so you were born and then raised in Ukraine.
Right.
And you've been in this country now for how long?
It's been 1.5 years.
All right. And how's it going?
It's great. A lot of insights into the U.S. politics that probably wouldn't be that available for me when I was in Ukraine.
Well, let me just say, sorry. I don't know what else to say, really. But is it fascinating?
Yes.
U.S. politics? Yeah. It is to us as well. I'm thrilled you're here today. Obviously all the mics are open, so whenever you have something to say and join in, and I'll call on you, and it's just a delight to meet you. I'm thrilled you're here today.
Thank you so much.
And congratulations. When do you graduate?
In spring 2025.
Oh, okay. Oh, good. So we've got you for a while. Fantastic. All right. So good.
We got
good,
a live
good.
One.
That's yeah. Right. We got them for a while. Good on you. Laurel Elder is here, professor of political science at Hartwick College in Oneonta, who studies gender and politics, women political candidates, women voters, and women in elected office, and is a wonderful new addition to this program. We couldn't be more thrilled. Laurel, good morning, and thank you for being here.
Good morning. I'm really excited to be part of the panel this morning.
Thank you. Very nice. I'm glad your schedule allows, and it's a great honor to have you here. Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, joins us. Good morning, Judy. How are you?
I am fine. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you here. Thank you very much, all. I do want to remind you that the lockbox is open. And what we're doing is, what the lockbox is that we have a fund drive that will begin on June 10th. In that fund drive, we need to raise $1.25 million. And what we need to do in the lockbox is make as much money now so we have less money to make later, because we're only taking a few moments out of your day to talk about it now. But when we start the on-air fund drive, it's going to be from the very, very early morning to night, and we'll take over the airwaves, and because that's necessary to keep the radio station going. But anything you can do now to help us is a dollar we don't have to make later on. So anything that you can do, anything that you can see that is helpful, we would love for you to do that. All you have to do is go to WAMC.org. wamc.org, wamc.org. This is also the point that I'll just do kind of a blanket announcement, but that wamc.org, if you would like to volunteer for the fund drive, if you would like to donate, if you're a restaurant or caterer or would like to donate food for the volunteers to the fund drive, if you would like to supply a challenge for us, challenges work, and 1,000 or 5,000 or whatever the case may be, those are very helpful as well. And anything like that would be great. And you can just go to WAMC.org or call 1-800-323-9262 and speak to Dina or whoever answers the telephone, and they'll put you in the right direction. But we all have to come together to make this possible and to make it work. It's a big deal. I think many of you know that public radio and public media are having difficulties, and there are entities all around us who are having great financial woes. We are not among them as far as to the point where we need to let staff go or to cancel programs, but certainly we're being impacted. Certainly the dollars that were there are not there as much, and we have some ground to make up. So all of that shows the fragility of public media and the fragility of public radio. It also shows the difference of WAMC, that because of you, because of our incredible audience, we're able to put up a barrier against some of the forces that other stations find difficult to deal with. So whatever you can do, we would love to hear from you. WAMC.org. Does anybody want to add anything about
that? I would love to. I just appreciate these reminders because it did remind me to make a contribution yesterday, and it was super easy right on the website. But also, and I was so happy to do so because I am such a believer in public radio. I teach a class on media and politics, and one of the topics we cover is how the news media is funded in the United States. And of course, with our capitalist economy, most of the news media is owned by private businesses, usually large corporations. And they're under a lot of pressure to make profits and show that to their stockholders. And as a result, what we realize is that the stories that get the most clicks and make the most money are not necessarily the stories that citizens need to be informed about their government, how policy affects their lives, and to hold their government officials accountable. So I think public radio plays such an important role. As you said, because it's funded by the public, it gives them the breathing room to really cover the important stories. So it was a good reminder. And the other thing is, every time you mention the lockbox, it reminds me of the 2000 debate between Bush and Gore when they were talking about, we actually had a surplus. The government actually took in more money than it spent, and they were debating what to do with it. And Gore kept saying we should put it in a lockbox for future generations. And so every time you say that, it brings me back 24 years ago. Seems like a different universe, though, that we had a surplus.
Yeah, this is a really, really long time ago in ancient history, but really not that long ago. Actually, the commercial media model is very circuitous. They go out and they get advertisers, and then they sell potato chips, and then you buy the potato chips, and then they put the ads in, and then somehow paying for those ads is what pays for the radio station. We just come right to you and beg. It's really easy.
Cut out the middle person.
Yeah, it's just a lot easier, I think. So, anybody else want to? Okay. All you have to do is go to WAMC.org, WAMC.org, and we would love to have you be a part of our fund drive. June 10th is the day we start the fund drive, and on right now, the lockbox is open. Need your help. WAMC.org, or you can call us 1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-9262. We'll talk much more about that later on as well, but I just wanted to put it on the table. All right, we have our panelists introduced. We have you knowing that we need your help. Now, let me just remind you that if you'd like to be a part of the program, all you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. All right, let's go to the items in the news. So Justice Samuel Alito, he's a justice on the United States Supreme Court and has been part of a controversy over the last several weeks, although the actual actions have been taking place for years, where there have been flags that often associate with far-right theories and conspiracy theories that have been flown over his house or houses, one of his main house, one in a New Jersey summer home. And so he did the first salvo in this was I didn't do it. It was my wife. And then more and more Democrats and others said, well, if you're talking about the subverting the election of 2020, maybe if the court is hearing these cases and this is how you feel about it, that you should recuse yourself from the Supreme Court. And the last several days has been a mounting call for Justice Alito to recuse himself from these cases regarding the January 6th, what's the word we want to use?
Insurrection.
Insurrection, thank you. to look at that and say, okay, maybe it's time for you to just sit on the sidelines. And so yesterday, with great fanfare, Justice Alito said no, that he will he will not recuse himself. He told this to Congress yesterday, and there were several congressional leaders, mostly Democrats, I think all Democrats, saying that he should recuse himself. And Alito said that he could be impartial after an upside-down flag flew at his home following the 2021 U.S. Capitol attack. I do want to get to the... this is the line. There are a couple of quotes here. As soon as I saw it, I asked my wife to take it down, but for several days she refused. Alito wrote in a letter to Senators Dick Durbin and Sheldon Whitehouse, who oversee the federal courts in their respective roles as chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee and a Judicial Oversight Subcommittee. My wife is fond of flying flags. I am not. He added, my wife was solely responsible for having flagpoles put at our residence and our vacation home and has flown a wide variety of flags over the years. The upside-down flag, long used as a signal of distress, especially by the U.S. military, has become a symbol of the Stop the Steal movement that falsely claims the 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump. Another flag carried by January 6th rioters, this one embraced by Christian nationalists who want to find a greater place for religion in public life, was flown outside Alito's vacation home in New Jersey last summer. So, Laura, let's begin with you. So it's all Mrs. Alito's fault.
Well, that seems to be part of the story that Justice Alito is telling. I mean, he tried to make, I think, a pretty persuasive, and some people might find this compelling case that his wife, Mrs. Alito, is a private citizen. She herself is not a Supreme Court justice, and she likes flags. She likes flying flags. She's flown many different ones. And, you know, he's like, she's a private citizen. She should be able to fly flags, and I support her ability to do so. But that, of course, misses the point, which is this is not a controversy about whether or not Mrs. Alito has the right to fly flags. She, of course, she does. She's a private citizen, and at her own home, the government can't interfere with her right to fly whatever flag she wants. But the issue here is whether Justice Alito should recuse himself from cases relating to Donald Trump and the January 6th insurrection and efforts to overturn the election. And that's a completely different issue. And the guidance or the rules from Congress that apply to all the federal judges, except the Supreme Court, because they see themselves as exempt, say that if there's an appearance of a conflict of interest, you should recuse yourself from the case. And so, you know, Justice Alito is saying, no, even though my wife has flown these flags, I can still be impartial. But the point is, it has the appearance of being, you know, a problem, of being biased. And so I think many people who are concerned with government ethics and judicial ethics would like to see him recuse himself. And of course, this is also important because the legitimacy of the courts and the perception of its legitimacy by the American public is its greatest source of power.
So I just want to not push back, really, but just ask a question. Is she a private citizen? I mean, if you were married to the justice of the United States Supreme Court, is Doug Emhoff a private citizen being married to the second lady of the United States? These are all questions that we will talk more about after this break. Music from Dizzy Gillespie this morning on the Roundtable, and we welcome you to join us in our conversation, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We are talking about the story about Justice Alito, United States Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito, who told Congress yesterday he will not recuse himself from January 6 related cases after many called for that as a result of flags that were flying at his house. We did hear from Laurel Elder just a moment ago about her thoughts on this issue, the upside down flag, as well as the flag embraced by Christian nationalists and what that means. Malia.
So there is, to my understanding, a Supreme Court precedent that directly relates to this from 2009. It's a case called Caperton versus A.T. Massey Coal Company, where the Supreme Court found that even though there was no evidence that a judge in that case was actually biased, that he should recuse himself anyway because of the appearance of bias that he had received of a large election donation. This is in one of those places where judges are elected. So they found no evidence of bias despite this large campaign donation by one of the parties to the lawsuit. The Supreme Court decided, no, the judge should recuse himself anyway. So I hope that we have some legal scholars who are listening in who can write in about whether that precedent is actually directly relevant in this case. But it seems to me that it is, just on you know, what I've read about it. And so I don't quite understand Samuel Alito's protestations. It just seems half-hearted and not really dedicated to the integrity of the actual judicial system. I don't know why he wouldn't abide by this seemingly direct relevant precedent.
Jamie Raskin, the congressperson from Maryland, had a pretty substantial op-ed in the New York Times, I think, yesterday. Raskin's also a fairly well-known constitutional scholar, maintaining that there are mechanisms that are at the disposal of the U.S. Attorney's Office, that they can file petition to under the due process clause of the Constitution, and there's some sort of federal law that would indeed require Alito to recuse himself, and Clarence Thomas, too. Let's make it clear about what's happening here. We've both got Clarence Thomas and Alito, who have indicated very clearly where they stood on the insurrection of from 2020. You know, I'd love to see what other flags Martha Ann loves to fly. I mean, we know about two. The judge says she likes many flags, and I wanted to make the point that while he respects her opinion to her First Amendment rights to express her opinion, he also didn't respect it enough to let her continue to fly the flag. He asked for it to be taken down. I imagine there was some discussion, and eventually it came down. I mean, in my profession, in the journalism world, even the appearance of a slightest bias, you are not supposed to go there. This is very clear bias. You are not supposed to. Do they have bumper stickers on their cars? Let's do some real looking at it. This is in part a reflection of the white glove treatment the media has given the Supreme Court for decades. I mean, the fact that the Washington Post knew about the story 3 years ago or when it first happened and said, nah, no story here. We need to take a harder look at this court.
And do you think it was no story because it was pre January 6th, although even the flag flew after that as well?
That's the excuse they use. But I believe that this is because, oh, you know, this is the justice. I'm sure that this was probably the wife. This is just a neighborhood dispute. Let's tone this down. The reporter who first found about it was a Supreme Court justice, and those guys tend to revere those justices. And I do not think that's healthy for holding them accountable.
I told a story on the air the other day that when I was in fourth grade at Stony Creek Elementary School in Bluebell, Pennsylvania, Stephen Rabney went out to put the flag up. It was his week, and he went out and put the flag up and accidentally put it out upside down. And the community went nuts. And everyone was called in, and that was taken care of very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have such things in place.
America seem to be obsessed with flags, though, isn't it? It seems like, you know, I think if you go to a European country, you don't see houses with flags outside their outside. It's not something we do here for some reason.
Well, you remember, I mean, after 9/11, and this isn't a bad thing, but 9/11, everyone was flying a flag. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they were taping them to their cars and everything else. And you drive down the highway and they'd just be littered off to the side of the road. And the thought of even people who are flying the flags out of the back of their pickup trucks, well, okay, that's fine, but still treat them with respect and the respect that comes with flying the United States flag. Take it down when it's raining. Fold it correctly.
Right.
All of those things that are expected as procedural things that we expect for the United States.
So I just want to point out that, so you mentioned, Judy, the sort of hands-off treatment that has, but that's partly because there aren't the same level of rules and laws governing the behavior of the civilian employees in the judicial system as there are in other parts of our government. So as a former federal employee myself, I was subject to the stipulations of the Hatch Act, which has been around since 1939 and very clearly lays out what I am and am not allowed to do. It's the full name of it is, just to give you a sense of what this, the Hatch Act, an act to prevent pernicious political activities. So I love that word, pernicious. And so it's very clear about what, in an effort to safeguard the integrity of the federal government, where the civilian employees, such as, you know, myself, I was not a political appointee. I was a permanent civil service hire, that we are meant to be nonpartisan, and we serve the government, we serve the public interest of the United States. And so the Hatch Act was designed to help safeguard that by preventing people in those kind of roles from doing certain things, like, you know, wearing certain, like, political kinds of t-shirt, or depending where you are, you do have rights as a private citizen that you don't give up, but it's laid out very clearly where you can and can't exercise those rights. And there isn't something, to my understanding, there isn't something similar for the judicial branch of the government. That's for executive branch folks.
Svetlana, what do you make of this, of the American perspective of flags and extrapolating it to our Supreme Court?
This is something that I noticed when I came to the U.S. for the first time. I saw a lot of huge U.S. flags, and it's something that I...
Yeah, mostly in front of car dealerships. Yes. The bigger ones are in front of car dealerships. I don't know why, but that seems to be a thing.
Does that happen in your country?
When the full-scale invasion began, I would say that we had much more flags. People were just handing them up on their balconies, out of the windows. And in Europe, people were doing it as well to support Ukraine. But another interesting thing that I noticed is that how people in the US are free about expressing their political views. And when you are driving on the road and you see these houses, and a lot of them have the sign next to them that kind of expresses whom they are going to support or what political views they have. And I think that this is not that common in Ukraine.
Yeah. And that is a relatively new phenomenon as far as, I mean, we could talk about the American flag, the use of the American flag, or even the Christian national flag, but it's a relatively new phenomenon, I think, that after Trump of flying the Trump flag and flying the F. Biden flag and flying the, don't tread on me. It just, that all seems to have come recently.
Yeah, like the whole, in this area, painting the side of the barn kind of thing, which I don't recall seeing prior to the last election that much.
Or the hay bales.
Yeah, or the hay bales, that's right.
There's probably a flag manufacturer behind all this.
All right, well, we have many letters. I'll get to a couple of them, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll return to more. Janet writes, good morning. While Mrs. Alito may have raised both flags, she raised them on the Alito property, and Justice Alito did not remove them. Isn't this giving consent for their presence as well as their message? Well, I think that's the core of the argument, right? I mean, I think that's exactly one of the questions that is at the center of this.
You know, in the meantime, today's Thursday, and typically we get Supreme Court decisions on Thursdays. We'll see what decisions come out today and what Judge Alito has to opine about.
We're still waiting on the immunity, right?
Right.
Yeah, that's the big one that we're waiting for. So.
Yeah, I think that this timing is really tricky because, yeah, the Supreme Court is going to be issuing a series of incredibly important decisions in the coming weeks. And another way the Supreme Court is different than the other branches is that they don't really have enforcement power. It's just the nine of them in black robes. They make decisions, and usually we all follow their decisions, city governments, state governments, corporations, individuals, because once again, that we recognize them as the legitimate interpreter of the Constitution and our laws. And so the legitimacy of the Supreme Court has been, waning. And I think a lot of Alito's colleagues are very deeply concerned about this and have been doing a lot of public outreach to try to restore its legitimacy. And so I can only imagine that Justice Alito's colleagues, some of them are really upset about this as further undermining their legitimacy in the eyes of many Americans.
Hey, Sam, what are you doing over the weekend? Oh, I'm going to go flag shopping. What are you doing, Clarence? Well, I got an RV from a friend, and we're going to go on a college tour for this person who isn't related to me.
Well, seriously, okay. John Roberts has got to buck up a little bit here. I think there are things he can do, and he should. And also, maybe the Democrats in the Senate should buck up. And if it were the Republicans, they would have a hold of hearing about this. But we're not hearing that from the Democrats, who are, when they go low, we go high. Well, maybe it's time to have a hearing on this.
This is one of the letters that we have. I want to take a break, but one of the letters that we have from this is what is Justice Roberts' responsibility in all of this? What is the responsibility of the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court when you have these issues? And I would refer to them as nagging issues because mm-hmm. they keep occurring. We'll take a break, and we will return with our wonderful panel right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And we have Malia Dumont, Laurel Elder, Judy Patrick, and Svetlana Kuharuk with us this morning. Thank you very much all for being here. We love having you here. And we're talking about Justice Samuel Alito telling Congress that he will not recuse himself from January 6th related cases. This is in response to many Democrats asking Justice Alito, hey, can you be impartial if you're flying these flags at your home and flying these flags at your home following the 2021 U.S. Capitol attack? I will say real quick, there is some interesting reporting on this, which we don't necessarily need to get into, but from the New York Times over the last couple of days about the fight between Mrs. Alito and the neighbor. And I think that is interesting. I don't think it takes away from those issues, the main issues that we're discussing. But I thought the reporting on it was certainly well done. All right, let's go back to letters, and we will continue the discussion here. We go to Bob. Even judges, especially judges, should expose their prejudices, not hide them. I assume that doesn't include, like, flying a flag to expose them. I think that's right. Is that what Bob means? I think so. Amy writes, does anyone on the panel know whether Justice Roberts, as Chief Justice, can force Alito to sit out the Trump case? I don't believe so.
Yeah, I don't think he can.
Yeah. They have tremendous individual power, correct, of what they will do and what they will not do. Parker writes, we all know where each of the Supreme Court justices stand on these issues in front of them. We don't need a flag to tell us. That's an interesting point, too. Doesn't make a difference because we already know, right? We know from their votes. We know from their decisions. We know from their dissents. We know from their opinions.
You know, it also brings to mind the idea that when we do the confirmation hearings for the Supreme Court justice, there's this, you know, rule that we can't ask them about their political opinions. Although I'm not going to talk about that. Well, you know what? Maybe going forward, we should be asking about their political opinions, because maybe that is indeed relevant to how they're going to act as a justice going forward.
Well, we do, but they always say the same thing, right?
No.
Which is, you know, I'm going to follow the law.
Yeah.
and not my personal belief. All right, let's go, which is very similar to what a jurist will agree to. So we'll get to that story in a moment. Let's go back to letters, and we talk to Ronald, who says, the Don't Tread on Me flag rose in popularity during Obama administration while racist hate groups exploded in numbers. Coincidence? Question mark. And then we go to Vincent. Wait, didn't Senator Menendez just blame his wife, too? Is this the new excuse du jour? Yeah.
It's not that new, though.
No,
I don't think it's new.
No, and not just a wife. Like, anyone they can blame, they'll blame. I don't know. Diane says, although Martha Ann is a private citizen, once her husband became a judge at whatever level, his professional ethics became hers. The same applies should the judge be female. It makes no difference of sex. All right. Then we go to Julie. Justice Alito blaming his wife for hanging far-right flag symbolism is laughably dishonest. As New York Times' Jamel Bouie, yes, points out, there is no question that he is a genuine Republican partisan who is more than willing to share his views that echo narratives aired from throughout conservative media, as he has frequently done in recent years. Alito acquiesces to his wife's flag-flying symbols because he heartily agrees with them, and asserting otherwise is just a lie. Then we go to Catherine. Representative Jamie Raskin wrote an editorial in the New York Times yesterday about the pressure that the Chief Justice or any of the SCOTUS justices could put on Alito to recuse himself. And again, I mean, you had Democrats, a large cry saying, please, you should recuse yourself. And Justice Alito told Congress, well, okay, I'm not going to. So that's sort of the end of it, right? I mean,
there's not much else they can do besides bring pressure to bear. And if he's impervious to that, then But he's got a lot of latitude.
Yeah, but I don't think they should let it go. This is something that we still need to focus on because there are more cases coming forward. And again, I think hearings are a great idea. Let's find out what's going on with these justices and where they stand and what they may be doing behind the scenes. I mean, remember the ProPublica reports last year that talked about how some of the justices were getting lavish gifts from people who eventually had cases before the court. So these things need to be brought to the light of day.
All right, we also, and is this true? My memory, I think the writer is William writes about this is the same justice who allegedly leaked the Dobbs decision. I don't know how those two exactly play into, but. But those are two fun facts, right?
Alleged, but never confirmed.
Never confirmed. Yes. All right. Let us move on to other subjects as we move into this Thursday morning conversation, and we welcome your letters, panel at wamc.org, panel at WAMC. Oh, this was the one. Okay, I apologize. I flagged a letter that I wanted to read. It kills me that Samuel Alito speaks of his wife's right to make her own decisions at the same time he was a major instrument in taking away a woman's right to make significant life choices. Thanks for having such a spectacular Ukrainian guest with you.
That's you.
WAMC hits yet another home run. Thank you very much for helping us in the baseball metaphor. And that letter was from Lena. So, Lena, thank you very much for that. All right, moving on to other things we should talk about, and we will talk about. The Trump jury has started to deliberate. Yesterday, at this time, when we were meeting for this program, the Justice Juan Merchan explained the 34 charges of falsifying business records that Donald Trump faces, and then jurors went behind closed doors to start their deliberations. That was just getting underway as we were wrapping up the program yesterday. So 24 hours later, we know that the jurors deliberated for, I believe, five and a half to six hours. Oh, they do. thank you very much, Judy. Thanks to our friends at CNN. They have a judge deliberation clock.
Wow.
And it's 5 hours and 1 minute for those of you keeping track at home. And so it is all up to the jury now after 7 weeks of legal wrangling and tawdry testimony. The first criminal trial of an American president moved to a jury of Donald Trump's peers on Wednesday morning, the final stage of the landmark trial. The moment the deliberations began marked a transfer of power from the experts in the courtroom, the lawyers arguing the case and the judge presiding over it, to the everyday New Yorkers who forfeited weeks of their lives to assess a mountain of evidence about sex and scandal. The jurors, who spent more than 4 hours deliberating on Wednesday without reaching a verdict, meet around a long table in an unremarkable room with unforgiving lighting and walls painted a hue best described as municipal.
Love that detail.
Located off a small hallway behind the courtroom, it is steps from the jury box and has a door at each end, outside of which a court officer stands guard. The judge, Juan Merchan, had invited the jurors to send him a note if they were confused about the law or wanted to revisit testimony from the trial. They took him up on the offer, buzzing the court officer to relay a message, requesting 4 excerpts from the testimony. On Thursday, a court reporter will read that testimony to the jury, most of which comes from David Pecker, the former publisher of the National Enquirer, whose prosecutors say was part of a conspiracy to suppress unflattering stories on Mr. Trump's behalf during the 2016 election. Another portion of testimony relates to Michael Cohen, Mr. Trump's former fixer, who was the prosecutor's star witness. Before the jurors began deliberating Wednesday, Justice Merchan delivered an array of legal instructions to guide their decision-making, He impressed on them the gravity of their task, but also said that the defendant, even a former president, is their peer. Quote, as a juror, you were asked to make a very important decision about another member of the community, Justice Merchan said, referring to the defendant, otherwise known as the 45th president of the United States. Before I go around the room here, we'll take a break, and so I'll tease it up. And when we come in back from the break, we'll go to our panel to discuss this of what will their thoughts on where we are in this deliberation, and which goes on. I believe the rereading of the jury instructions is going on now. So we'll have more updates and discuss the story in much more detail after this break and news from Ragraph. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Malia DeMontelurl Elder, Judy Patrick, and Svetlana Kuharuk, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Svetlana was telling us about her past semester that she spent in New York City and in Williamsburg, and also and what did that your specific Penn America was where you were spending time, right?
Right.
And talking about that's fascinating. All right. Well, I can. The whole show interviewing you about those experiences, but we'll move on and we'll get your thoughts on some of these issues as we move forward. So I set up the story right before the break about the jury and the Donald Trump hush money trial beginning to sift through evidence as it weighs Trump's fate in the criminal court. The jury has been deliberating now for 5 hours and 12 minutes, according to the CNN deliberation clock. And so I set it up. Who would like to go first as to thoughts on what the jury is going with?
So what you're seeing is the media treading water because nothing's happening.
No.
They know nothing. It's speculation, filling time. And in fact, the story you read earlier about describing the meeting, the long table, the municipal colored walls, that there's nothing to write about when the jury is out. I expect the jury is going to take a little bit of time because they don't want to be viewed as rushing the verdict. But I think they could come back today, later today. Or maybe tomorrow. I'm surprised they're not sequestered. Is that correct? They get to go home.
I believe so.
Yeah.
There was some question as if it went into the weekend of whether they would be sequestered. I don't really understand what the difference would be, but of the difference of letting them go for a night.
And this is just showing the oddities of New York State's court system. The fact that we're hearing national commentators have to recite what's happening in court because we don't have cameras in the court, first of all. And then the other thing people are saying, wow, in New York State courts, they don't get to take a written copy of the judge's instruction with them. In federal courts, we get to do that. Isn't this strange? And then when they do the readbacks, they come back into the courtroom and then they get the testimony read back to them. I'm surprised that the jurors nowadays even get to take notes, because when I was covering jury trials, they didn't even get to take notes back then.
Right.
So you're just supposed to retain as much as you could and then make a verdict. So the media, I think the deliberation clock is a little bit too much.
For me, it's very handy. I can just look up.
We're going to find out what they're having for lunch next. And there's just nothing else to report or speculate about. Well, they're asking questions about this. What could this possibly mean?
Right.
It's
well, inevitably, and I'm sure it's already been asked about 15 times on the various cable networks, which is, it's been this long. What does that indicate?
Right.
They've asked this question.
That's
what
good
does
for
that
the
indicate?
Defendant.
Yes,
yeah.
Right. It's good for the prosecution. Good for the defendant.
My advice is to watch Jury Duty. It's a television series.
Oh,
it's on Prime.
So good.
And so it gives you it's a better use of your time as you wait for the jury to come back in.
Yes, and really, I mean, it's a satire of the judiciary. Well, of the judicial system, although I think, like good satire, it tells you so much about the process. It really is fascinating. Malia Dumont.
So 34 counts and 55 pages of instructions. I mean, even if they only spend an hour talking about each count and making sure they're sort of carefully looking at it, that's going to take them more than a week to go through all this. So, I have no idea. I have no more idea than any of the rest of us. But I wouldn't be surprised if it takes more than a week. And so this countdown clock that CNN is currently displaying, how long we could take bets on all kinds of things. How long will CNN keep the countdown clock front and center? People get tired of seeing that up there all the time after a day or two, I would think. So I don't have much to say other than that, except that I also like use of the word municipal
as a color. Yes. New from Sherwin-Williams.
Right. I do think this does underscore the powerful role of regular Americans in our judicial and our jury system, which is important. I mean, because for weeks now we've been hearing what the news media who are in the courtroom think about the arguments. We've been hearing legal experts who have tried a lot of cases weigh in the news media. We've heard what Donald Trump and his surrogates think about the case. And now it's up to 12, regular Americans, New Yorkers, and their deliberations with each other, and they're going to decide the fate of Donald Trump and whether they feel that he's committed felonies or not. And I also thought it was interesting, the 55 pages of jury instructions, which once again were read to the jurors. They didn't get a hard copy of it. And it just sort of underscores some of the key points that I think we all know, but it's a good reminder. The judge reminded them all that they, whatever they think about Donald Trump, they like him, they don't like him. They really need to try to be unbiased and just evaluate the evidence. Reminding them, really important point, that the burden of proof is on the prosecution, that the government needs to prove with beyond a reasonable doubt, and he even talked about what that term means, that Trump is guilty, reminding them that the fact that Trump did not testify is okay and should not be held against him, and that it is not Trump's responsibility to prove that he is not guilty. That's not his responsibility. So I just thought all that was pretty interesting, but all that was led up to the judge then discussing the law and how it applied, and there was like 20 plus pages of that. So, I teach, and I teach classes that are 55 minutes or an hour and 20 minutes long. And I'll tell you, if I stood up in front of my class and read a 55-page document, even the most energetic, well-rested professional students would not be able to follow that. I just think that it's too much to take in. And as we said, a lot of the jurors aren't taking notes. So I think it makes perfect sense that the jury is going to come forward and say, can you, reread us part of the testimony? Can you reread us part of our instructions? And I think that shows that they are taking the job seriously.
You mentioned the reading of the jury instructions and going on so long, but that was also one day following the final arguments that were given from both the prosecution and the defense, which I believe went nearly 11 hours. So, yeah, good luck. How would you like to be a college student with that, Svetlana?
I generally just can say that Ukrainians are closely following what is happening in the U.S. They are reading news about the political situation, about the upcoming elections, because we realize that it might have an impact on the war in Ukraine.
Is there a unified thought as to what would benefit an outcome that would benefit Ukraine over another outcome?
I'm not sure there is a unified thought. And since I've been in the U.S. for the last 1.5 years, I think I'm not in that informational bubble that much anymore, so I don't think I can speak on behalf of all Ukrainians about that.
So let me ask about then going back during the Trump administration from the years of 2016 to 2020, when you obviously would have been much younger, but of what the reaction was to the Trump administration, and that we can perhaps extrapolate as to what the response would be if he were to return to power.
I mean, at that time, the war in Ukraine was already ongoing because Russia occupied territories of Ukraine in 2014, annexed Crimea, and the invasion began 10 years ago. So I think at that point, what people just hope to is to get support to, you know, avoid more Ukrainians dying in this war and actually be able to join NATO and become a part of the European Union.
It's a very diplomatic answer. That was very good. Do you think we can extrapolate, Malia?
I don't want to speak for all Ukrainians either, but generally my understanding is, you know, based on what I can extrapolate from Donald Trump's previous actions.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So he's been, I mean, he's skeptical of NATO largely because so many countries, I mean, and he's right that so many countries haven't lived up to their commitments. There is a commitment when you join NATO. You agree that individual countries agree to spend at least 2% of their GDP on defense-related budgets, and a lot of countries in Europe haven't been doing that for various reasons. So his complaint that the U.S. has been sort of pulling more than its fair share in NATO is accurate, and that's been a complaint of a lot of people for a long time, but he sort of brought it to the forefront. So he's been skeptical about NATO. He, as we all know, he has been admiring of Putin in various instances, and I don't think he wants to continue the same level of support that the United States has been providing to Ukraine. Now, the Senate is the one that determines, you know, what those budgetary expenditures are going to be. So it's not completely up to Donald Trump, but certainly it makes a difference who's in the White House, obviously.
Right. Remember back in the Trump administration, he had the very perfect telephone call with President Zelensky.
Very
perfect.
He said,
you can have these important weapons to defend yourself if you do some investigation into my potential political opponent, Joe Biden. So he's never been a true friend of Ukraine. I think that's...
He's a deal maker always, or he tries to be.
The art of the deal. Jory writes to us and says, Joe described the jury as Trump's peers. Love him or hate him, Trump has no peers whatsoever. Well, that obviously is not my language. That is the language of the court and what the judge, Judge Merchan, told the jury yesterday as they begin their deliberations. So,
who was the name of the person who wrote in?
Jory.
Oh, Jory. Well, Jory may be foreshadowing some kind of appeal strategy that the Trump side might use if they end up getting some guilty verdicts. That, you know, I'm sure they'll bring up every possible objection, including that the jury wasn't well chosen or, you know, whatever.
You know, the longer this takes, the more I worry about the growing crowd potentially outside that courtroom and what will happen when a verdict finally does come in. I think something the police department in New York City is watching. And again, that's the media focus at this point because there's no other news again. But I worry that the more this goes on, the more people will get stirred up and show up down there in downtown Manhattan.
Oh, Svetlana saw something about this when you were in New York City, right? We were talking about this on the ride up here.
What did you see?
Yeah, I saw like the helicopter flying over the Hudson River and it was going back and forth. And there was this big white banner after it. And at first I couldn't really see what was on it. But then I zoomed in with my camera on the phone.
Uh-huh.
And I saw it was saying, quote, when you indict him, you unite us. Period. MAGA. And then the U.S. flag.
Wow.
Fascinating.
So the pressure's on.
Everyone that just used to go up and down the, like the Jersey Shore, talking about wine coolers. Those are the good old days of airplane advertising. Different now. We have about 10 minutes before we go to a break. We have one more letter here from John, who writes, the jury is taking their job seriously, knowing this may be the last jury that tries Trump for anything. If he gets reelected, there certainly won't be any trials against him. When was the last time Putin went on trial? That is from John. All right, let's move on to other topics, and I want to go to, there is a topic that is related, but I think I'm going to hold that until after the break, because I think it'll take more time, about allies and advisors pressuring President Biden to allow attacks on Russian territory. I would like to hold that story just because it's going to take us a little more time. I don't think the polling story will take us that long, so let us do that one. I thought it was interesting, however, in the New York Times there is a story. This is from our friend, Nate Cohn, who writes, perhaps lost in all the polling, the race for president is still close. Though he trails in the polls, President Biden has mostly held his support among white voters. Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin probably offer his clearest path to victory. I found this article interesting because I think there seems to be a narrative that is emerging, and I will admit that I was sort of buying into this narrative, which is that the race was running away from President Biden, that it was almost becoming out of reach, that Trump was gaining a great deal of support no matter how much time he's spending in a courtroom or whatever brouhaha comes as a result of a rally, or that he's the what's the kind word I can say about the stuff he's posting online? Just off.
Drivel.
A little off. And so what impact that has on the election. And Nate Cohn writes, well, there's no way around it. The news for President Biden hasn't been great. He's trailed in national and battleground state polls for months. His approval ratings are among the lowest on record for a first-term president. He's struggling among Black and Hispanic voters. And all of this against an opponent who faces several criminal trials, including one that could have a verdict soon. But the news is not all bad for Biden, or at least it's not all that bad. The race is still close. It's close enough that he would have a very serious chance to win if the election were held tomorrow. And of course, the race won't be held tomorrow. There are 5+ months to go for a possible Biden comeback. Together, there's a case for taking a glass, almost half full perspective on Mr. Biden's chances. Right or wrong, it's a case that maybe hasn't gotten quite as much attention as it deserves. And then Nate Cohn turns to the electoral map to bolster the argument that there is a path to victory. So I take that last line of what I just read, Judy, right or wrong, it's a case that maybe hasn't gotten quite as much attention as it deserves. Damn media.
Well, damn Nate Cohn. Maybe he should have written the story when the poll first came out. I mean, let's call it like it is. I mean, this was New York Times poll. There are other polls that have done the same thing. This is the problem with poll coverage or horse race coverage of politics. In part, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, because if people believe that one candidate or another is behind, they're less likely to gravitate toward them. It's demoralizing to the campaign. It's bad. It's bad politics. It's bad for the electorate, because we're not talking about the issues. We're talking about the horse race coverage. When you watch a horse race, They all go into the gate or whatever, and then the bell goes off, and then they run the race, and then somebody wins. That's how we're handicapping.
And invariably, one of the horses dies.
And we're handicapping the race at now. Oh, Joe, we're handicapping the race at like the first furlong or whatever. I do think it's reasonable for the Democrats to look at their vulnerabilities, and there are vulnerabilities there, but not to give up hope. And I think that's what many Democrats have done.
Mike, I think we should just isolate the audio of Judy saying, damn Nate Cohn. That would be...
Did I say that? Yeah, oh, I apologize. I shouldn't swear.
No, it's fine. Laurel.
I think that... it's going to be a super close election. And the reason I think that is not because of the polls, it's because we are such a divided nation in terms of partisanship. So in terms of whether people see themselves as Democrats or Republicans, and a lot of people are like, no, I'm neither. But the research shows that even these people who say they're neither, when pushed, will say, oh, well, I sort of lean to the Republican or Democratic side. And then when you follow their behavior, they actually are quite partisan. So we have about 50% Democrats, 50% Republicans, and that is the strongest force shaping people's vote. It also shapes what they think about the trial with Trump. It's what they think about all sorts of current events that are taking place, and it's really hard to change that. So I do think, you know, national polls have shown for a while Trump is leading by a small amount. Of course, that's not, as you mentioned, that's not how we pick our presidents. We do it through the Electoral College. Trump does have a slightly larger lead in the 7 swing states that are going to probably make the difference in this election. But it's not a huge lead, as Nate Cohn points out. And we are 5 months out. And right now what we're seeing is a lot of forgetfulness. People are not remembering how they felt and what they thought during Trump's presidency. And that's likely to change with the campaigns over the next few months. And it'll be interesting to see how that changes things. Right now, Joe Biden has very low approval ratings. And that's largely because there's a good chunk of Democrats who are just feeling blah about him. And it'll be interesting to see how that group changes over the next few months.
I just want to get to Judy's point too, going back to on the heels of what you just said, of where was the coverage of this at the time of the poll. But in the New York Times, Philadelphia Inquirer, Siena College poll, Mr. Trump led by an average of 1 percentage point across the 3 states among likely voters. This is Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. The 538 and Real Clear Politics polling averages both show Mr. Biden ahead by barely a point across those states, and Mr. Trump doesn't appear to lead by more than around 2 points in any of them. As a consequence, Mr. Biden is within 2 points in states worth 270 electoral votes. Looking back over the longer run, his 2-point deficit in the key states makes this election closer than those heading into Election Day in 2020, 2016, 2012, and 2008. If the election were held tomorrow, it wouldn't be especially surprising if Mr. Biden won by sweeping these 3 states.
Yeah, if he won, based on that, he would get exactly 270 votes in the Electoral College. So
and that's what you need.
That's what you need. I mean, that's basically what it was in 2000. I think Bush had 271.
Malia, we have about a minute.
I think the Biden campaign might enjoy the narrative of painting Biden as a comeback person. I mean, it helps them combat the old age narrative as well. Someone, you know, young and vigorous, and it gives a sense of something positive that's sort of exciting that voters can jump on board with. I also think that what we're going to see as we head into the beginning of summer is the local races starting to heat up. So and that will impact how voters are thinking about the national election as well. So now we're starting to see the congressional candidates be much more active. And that, I think, is going to remind people of how the national race connects directly to local issues. And you're going to see a lot of candidates emphasizing women's right to choose, And whether or not the Biden campaign focuses on that themselves, I think it'll come through these local elections, and that could potentially help the Biden campaign as well.
All right, we'll hold there, and we'll take a break. When we come back, we will wrap up the program, and we have another topic or two under our belt. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we certainly welcome your comments as we move forward. We will be back after this message and news break. You know, we've been doing this show for a long time, and over the years, people say, well, the problem with that show is that you're always just doing bad news. So I thought I would talk about pandas.
Yay.
I'm very excited about pandas. I was born in Washington, D.C. I did not live there for a tremendous amount of time, the first 3 years of my life, and then moved out of the district and went to Philadelphia. But we made regular visits to the National Zoo throughout my life and continue to. I miss the pandas. I miss the pandas. It felt better. We had panda cams. We could see what was going on with the pandas. The Smithsonian's National Zoo announced Wednesday that two new pandas, a two-year-old male and a two-year-old female, will be arriving from China later this year. And one, the male panda, has family roots in Washington, D.C. He is the son of a female giant panda who was born at the zoo in 2013, and the grandson of the panda couple whose departure from the zoo last year broke hearts and signaled the end of an era, because for decades the pandas had been a part of the National Zoo. Now comes a new era and a chance for fresh generations of zoo visitors to experience the thrill of panda mania and the hope that the new bears will someday produce cubs. I am filled with such joy right now, said Brandy Smith, the zoo's director. It's hard to express it. The program is so important to giant pandas, she said in a telephone interview. We are working to save an endangered species. Smith said giant pandas have drawn millions of visitors to D.C., and millions more have watched the zoo's pandas on the Panda Cam. I'm excited for us. I'm excited for them. The announcement was a surprise given the tense relationship between the United States and China, which owns and leases all giant pandas in U.S. zoos. I was walking through the building yesterday when I heard about the 10-year panda lease, and I just had to like giggle that there's a 10-year panda lease. But hey, whatever it takes to make this possible. In remarks at the zoo, the Chinese ambassador to the United States said the two countries should be on better terms. This is a 10-year lease, as I mentioned. It ends in April of 2034, during which the zoo will pay the China Wildlife and Conservation Association $1 million a year. And it is, for anyone who's ever been to the National Zoo, the centerpiece of that zoo are the pandas. And I assume none of that has really been altered or changed, because I think they were always hoping that they would be able to return the pandas to that section. But the way they have it laid out gives you so many different vantage points. And so wherever the pandas are at any given time, you can see them. And here's the thing that I've learned after years and years of panda watching. My God, are they cute. Mm-hmm. Those little round ears are just adorable. Those perfect Oreo ears are just perfect. And I'm very, very excited about the pandas coming to D.C. later this year.
I agree wholeheartedly. I was at the Washington, D.C. Zoo when one of the baby Pandas was there, and it was as good as I dreamed it would be. And I got myself a panda mug, which I use every morning. And in fact, when I was donating to WAMC, it was like, do you want a mug? I was like, no, I have my panda mug that I use every morning, so I don't need, and I can't give it up. So I was probably naive, perhaps like many Americans. I didn't realize the pandas weren't ours. And so last year, when I realized they were going to be put in boxes and sent back to China, that we had just leased them, I was so sad. And so this story that they are coming back, I just think it makes so many people happy. I imagine Republicans and Democrats alike. I mean, there are a few panda skeptics out there and a few panda haters. But I think most people are so thrilled at this and so happy about this.
The diplomacy that must have taken place to make this possible is mind-boggling to me. But I have no problem with it if it's something that is I think it's good for both China and the United States, and it's certainly good for kids and adults to be able to see these amazing animals and also to bring more into the world so that we can, as you mentioned, the baby pandas, which are just god adorable. I remember seeing those too, and you go in and there was a line at the zoo, mm-hmm. like 4 miles long. And longer than the line to get into the Supreme Court, which I think is
pandas are cuter when they're sleeping than Clarence Thomas.
That's absolutely true. Oh, they have like a little straw in their hand, and they're just very cute. I want to go to you, Malia, but I have to say I've watched Judy now roll her eyes at least 4 times.
Oh, no. Is she a panda skeptic?
Are you a panda hater, Judy?
I was saying this not to have to talk about this.
I was ready to go to Malia, and I just keep looking at Judy, and Judy's like,
The over-the-top glee about these pandas. Just remember, it was just last week or the week before that the president of China was meeting with Vladimir Putin. What happened in this panda diplomacy that precipitated the return of these pandas? I am all in favor of saving endangered species, but every time I go online and social media, I find videos, short clips of these pandas rolling around doing stupid things, and people saying it's a wonder they can survive.
You are a hardened journalist.
Wow!
And we're giving them $1 million. What cuddly, cute animal can we, as Americans, send to China and to reciprocate?
Well, they make $1 million off the mugs, the T-shirts, the stuffed animals, you know, probably in a week. To pay for what is being paid out.
I hate to disagree with you, Joe, on this one, but I just do not think they're that cute.
Really?
I like a stuffed one, an artificial one, sure, but the other ones, they tend to look...
I don't know.
They're like lumps, and they're usually asleep. God help me, I know.
I love, it's funny you say that because much like polar bears, panda bears are those great bears that you want to go up and give a big hug to.
No, you don't.
But you know that you will die as a result of it. So I think that's kind of cool. Malia, you spend a lot of time in D.C.
Yes, I used to live there, and you know, there are plenty of philosophical and ethical arguments against the existence of zoos, but people should know, people who have never been to or don't live in D.C., that the National Zoo is one of the Smithsonian institutions, which means it's paid for by our taxpayer dollars, our federal taxpayer dollars, and it is one of the gems of the Smithsonian system. So it's free to visit, and so that's...
Amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing, and it's wonderful to go to year-round, and winter is when the pandas tend to be a little bit more active. They're especially cuddly. Yes, now Judy's rolling her eyes at me. She doesn't believe they're cuter in the snow. Just a quick...
I'm sorry. While you do that,
we're looking at videos of pandas rolling around now.
I mean, how is that not cute?
How can anyone resist?
Just adorable. Okay, go ahead.
Just a quick pronunciation guide for those who are interested
you.
In the names of these pandas. So one of them is named Bao Li, and the other one is named Qing Bao. The Q-I-N-G, that sound in Chinese confounds a lot of people. It's pronounced Qing. So we will all, except for Judy, fall in love with Baoli and Qing Bao. This is actually a big thing in diplomacy. Mm-hmm. Panda diplomacy is, we can sort of laugh and joke about it, but it is serious. It is serious in China, and they know exactly what Judy just pointed out, that this is taking over. This is more of a headline now than what you just brought up, which is arguably much more important in great power politics in the world. Are Americans paying attention to the fact that Xi and Putin have strengthened their relationship, and China is now essentially floating the Russian war effort in Ukraine?
But no, we got pandas.
We got pandas, and so China is very aware of the sort of soft power value of that, and they've been, of course, wanting to improve their the perceptions that Americans have of pandas, of the country.
Of the country. I just also want to say that there are many, many families, and we know this from what they do, from the information that they derive from the National Zoo, the Smithsonian, as well as the federal government, that people will go out and buy plane tickets for their children and themselves, so they can go to the National Zoo to see the pandas. It is something that brings people into the city, that brings people to a national. It's not a national park. It's a Smithsonian.
It's part of the Smithsonian. Yeah.
Yes, the Smithsonian, and so it's a.
But it's located inside Rock Creek Park, which is a national park.
Which is a beautiful place.
Yes,
just an absolutely gorgeous place. Any thoughts on panda bears?
Do you have pandas in Ukraine?
I would think so.
They're only in China. They're only in China. That's why they're so special.
Yeah. Have you ever seen a panda?
I think I did, but yeah. Maybe. but I actually agree with what Melia said and what we heard here, that there are also other things that we should be talking about, and how those countries just work together to perhaps introduce the new world order. And that's something we need to pay attention to.
Bo Li?
Bao.
Oh, it's Bao. I'm sorry. B-O-W. Bao.
Oh.
No, you're right. Bao Li.
Okay, the headline I'm looking at spelled it B-A-O.
Means treasure, mm-hmm. and energetic in Mandarin Chinese. Mm-hmm. And then Qingbao would be green and treasure.
Mm-hmm.
So two treasures that we have on their way. I wonder how they were chosen. That's fascinating to me.
Like, I just love the look of joy on your face, Joe. You're just so happy about this. This is nice.
I am. I will say that when the gates open to the zoo, you immediately make like the run for the
like at the racetrack,
Panda Land. Well, yeah. And you go and I don't know. It's hard to go see anything after that that's that exciting and sort of lovely. But I will also, I will admit this to you, Judy. This was part of my youth. Like, this is what I grew up with.
You grew up with a raccoon, I know.
Well, yes.
Just
I
a
did.
Relation to pandas.
Yes, I did. But I.
Yeah, they look a lot like a panda. You know,
well, they're cute. They're just adorable.
They're roly poly.
As I said, those ears are just amazing. But I grew up seeing the pandas and having them part of my childhood. They were there for, what, 50 years, right? So I think that nostalgia, too, that we had this program going for so long. All right. Let me check and see if there's any letters.
Please don't hate
pandas.
Me for what I said.
I'm just wondering if we have any panda letters. And I'm so hoping we do, but I'm not sure yet. I'm going through the... let's see here.
They used to have red pandas at the
yes.
zoo as well.
Yes.
So there's more than one species of panda, and the red pandas are more the size of raccoons, but they're sort of reddish, and they're beautiful as well.
Yeah. And you learn a lot. I mean, this is what I think the Smithsonian does so beautifully, and zoos in general, especially zoos that are working very diligently on the protection of the species, there's so much information and so much science and so much data that is available that if you are the casual, you know, if you're six and you're going to see a panda, you can go see a panda. But if you're more interested in the science of it, that is available too,
yeah.
Which I think is really important.
The Smithsonian has a big conservation facility out in Northern Virginia where they help breed and take care of all these animals.
All right. There are no panda letters.
thank goodness.
Yes. Any that come in, I will
forward to you.
All right. My thanks to everybody for being with us. Special thanks to Svetlana for being here. It's an absolute delight to have you on the program. I hope you'll come back. You're always welcome. And your perspective is amazing, and we really I'm glad you're going to be around until 2025. That's quite nice. So I hope you'll come back.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Judy, thanks. Malia and Laurel, thank you very much. We'll be back right after this.